There is a real analogy, which isn't discussed much, but I think is valuable and worth thinking about. The real analogy, in my opinion, is that, I've written about this, that we know from declassified documents that by around 1960, the apartheid regime realized that they're becoming an international pariah. In fact, in 1958, the South African foreign minister called in the American ambassador and told him, frankly, you know, we're becoming an international pariah, we're getting delegitimized, everyone's voting against us in the United Nations. This is 1958. But we don't really care as because you and I both know there's only one vote in the United Nations, that's yours. And as long as you vote for us and support us, we're okay. So if the whole world, you know, says we're horrible and so on and so forth, fine, we'll get along fine. Well, that's pretty much what happened if you look at it. Not entirely, but pretty much. So in mid-70s, the United Nations declared an arms embargo. By the late 70s, there were the beginnings of the sanctions, boycotts and so on, scattered. But by the 80s, they were really taking shape. By the mid-80s, Ronald Reagan vetoed congressional sanctions, and Congress overrode his vetoes. So he was forced to continue his support for South Africa. He was a very strong supporter of apartheid. He had to continue do it by evading congressional legislation. Now, he had a logic to it. It wasn't out of nowhere. You have to remember that the so-called war on terror, it was not declared by George Bush. It was declared by Ronald Reagan in 1981. He came into office saying international terrorism, core of our foreign policy, and so on. And there was a terrorist group in South Africa. It was called the African National Congress. In 1988, right at the end of the period, the Reagan administration declared the African National Congress, Mandela's Congress, to be one of the more notorious terrorist groups in the world. Well, obviously, you have to protect the white population from some of the worst terrorists in the world. So therefore, it was necessary to evade congressional sanctions, increase trade, and figure out ways to get oil and military aid to them, and so on. So that takes to the late 80s. Now, at that point, two important things happened. One of them we're not supposed to talk about. It's not politically correct. One of them had to do with Cuba. Cuba played an enormous role in liberating black Africa. It started earlier than that. It started in the 80s. Cuba sent soldiers, and crucially black soldiers, to Angola first, and they drove out the South African invaders, liberated Angola, other countries too. Now that was doubly important. For one thing, it liberated them, but for another, it was psychologically very significant, because there's a whole mythology about the invincible white mercenaries, you know, it goes back to the early days of colonialism. Well, here are black soldiers coming in and kicking them out. And that had a big effect both on South Africa and on black Africa. And strikingly, Cuba never took any credit for this. It's an act of international solidarity that has absolutely no counterpart in history. They didn't want it, they let the black leaders in Southern Africa take the credit for it. They wanted them to take the credit for it because they wanted to liberate them, not to get plaudits. And in fact, it's only very recently they've even allowed their archives to be opened. So, you know, the United States was all hysterical about communist aggression and so on. But that's, in fact, what happened. By the late 80s, it extended to Namibia. South Africa was holding Namibia in violation of Security Council orders. Cuba, again, black armies, drove them out of Namibia. That was a big blow, again, both strategically and also psychologically. So that's one thing that happened. The other thing that happened is that around 1990 or so, the United States changed its policy. We don't have records from that period, so you have to guess. But it looks as though U.S. corporate sector, U.S. government, South African white business realized that they would probably do better if they allowed black faces in the limousines, but reinstituted pretty much the same economic system. And that's essentially what happened. So apartheid collapsed, which is a great victory. I don't mean to demean it. It was a tremendous victory. But for most of the population, it doesn't mean a lot. You know, but the mass of the black population is as bad off, sometimes worse off than before. We saw that recently in the great strikes. But it is different. It's actually kind of like the civil rights struggle here, not unlike that in some ways. And it was a recognition that this is just a pointless system. What we want is the economic system and the wealth and the power, and we can keep it by getting rid of the worst aspects of apartheid. So apartheid collapsed, which is a great victory by the early 90s. And that's pretty much how it collapsed. Well, that tells us something. I do think there are lessons from that for Israel-Palestine. It was primarily, there isn't any Cuba around in this case, but there is the United States. The United States is blocking, 35 years now, has been blocking what a short-term option, two-state settlement, which in my view could be a stage, in fact the only stage I can think of, towards preferable longer-term options. So we might ask, what kind of tactics does that suggest to us? Well, I think the primary tactic it suggests to us is pretty much what was done in South Africa. The organized actions against apartheid, which by the 80s were pretty significant, that followed a long period of education and organization, decades. By the time sanctions were talked about even, there was just overwhelming opposition to apartheid, almost universal. Even business was opposed to it formally. As I said, Congress was passing sanctions, UN passing sanctions. At that point, it did make sense to begin using what are now called BDS tactics. It's worth remembering there was no BDS movement in the case of South Africa. Nobody ever dreamed of having a BDS movement. Rather, there was resort to those tactics, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, selectively targeted, considering the impact, dual impact. First of all, what would it mean to South Africa? And secondly, the educational impact. When you carry out a sanctions program, you're aiming it at the audience that you want to enlist in it. So you want to know how they're going to react to the program that I'm proposing. And that was done pretty sensibly in the case of South Africa. Sometimes wrong, but often very effectively. And it ended up being an effective program. It did ultimately bring even the Reagan administration around to joining. Although I should tell you, maybe you know, that Nelson Mandela himself was just removed from the terrorist list about 4 or 5 years ago. He can now come into the United States without special dispensation. So, you know, maybe slow, but it finally happened. And I think that tells us something too.